I received an email the other day, and I don't know who the party is. It's just Carrie Ann, and I'm going to write back after I give this sermon here, because this will be an answer to her question on a tape, and I'll tell her if she wants to hear the answer, then she send me her address and we'll send her the tape. And this is typical of the problems that so many people face because of the confusion that set in after the 70s. She said, I am currently attending both Living Church of God and United Church of God. Now I've come across this webpage, meaning ours. Do you have worldwide churches or is this an individual effort? I'm also interested in your position regarding church government and going to restaurants on the Sabbath. So my topic today is entitled A Sabbath Question. You can pick up information, material on internet that covers this subject. One comment that I recall reading, one fellow wrote an article and he said, it has been stated that in the early 50s, 60s, and 70s, church members never went out for a meal on the Sabbath. Now, when I read that, what it tells me is that a Johnny-come-lately got an advice or answer from another Johnny-come-lately. Because they don't know what happened in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I know what happened there because I was there. Never went out on the Sabbath. That answer is not quite true. So now what is being asserted on this viewpoint about eating out on the Sabbath is that we profane the Sabbath by going to a restaurant on that day, by paying for a meal prepared for us. We are contributing to their Sabbath breaking. We are hiring them temporarily and paying their wages by going there. We are conducting business by going to a restaurant, since a restaurant is a business. Are those statements true? Well, we'll examine them as we proceed here. Before I do, however, I'd like to read some comments of articles that were written in the past by the church on the Sabbath. Here's one entitled, How to Observe the Sabbath, written in June 1951. And what I'll read here. Jesus' disciples were accused of breaking the Sabbath day because they, and we'll come back to this later on, they plucked corn to eat. Actually, they weren't plucking corn, it was wheat. And if you've ever, I haven't commented on this before, I've done it many times, and the wheat is, grain has got this golden tone to it, and it's ready to harvest. Just take some heads and go like that, blow the huff off, the chaff off, and pop it in your mouth, and you chew it, and it'll actually turn into gum, a wad of gum if you chew it long enough. Jesus' answer is found in Matthew 12, verses 3 through 6, shows that it is permissible to obtain food to eat on the Sabbath. Christ knew how the Sabbath should be observed. And he said, you would not have condemned the guiltless. Now, as this article goes on to say, the Sabbath was not a fast day. The Israelites cooked their victuals on that day, for which, of course, a fire would be necessary. And this view of the institution was supported by the conduct of our Lord in Luke 14, verse 1. We'll come back to that later. And, of course, they got the manna on the sixth day, and then they were prepared it for the following day. And we'll see some other examples here as I proceed here, but the Sabbath emergency is a genuine emergency, not an excuse to break the Sabbath. So this particular article here is talking about emergency situations that make it permissible to eat on the Sabbath. We'll detail this more so as we proceed. Here's a co-worker letter written in 1959. Now, I remember very well what took place at the Feast of Tabernacles back in the 50s. Some of you may remember it if you go back that far. They served meals at the tabernacle. The first Feast of Tabernacles I ever attended, I think I remember, this was in 1955. Mr. Armstrong stood up there, and we were meeting in the old Redwood building, and the whole north side of it was wide open, and a norther came in, and everybody sat there shivering. And I didn't have enough sense to take some second tithe and go buy a jacket. I just sat there in a short sleeve shirt and shivered the whole feast. But Mr. Armstrong said, Brethren, we now have the largest feast ever. We have 1,500 people here. Well, those 1,500 people ate in the tabernacle. They ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner there. Somebody had to do all the preparing and the cooking, didn't they? So this letter says this: be doubly sure you put all 11 out of your homes if you're traveling to observe the feast. If traveling, you will probably have to eat in restaurants or buy food. Now let me ask you this question. We have during the days of unleavened bread, 7 days, we also have a weekly Sabbath, don't we? According to this line of reasoning here, that this article on the internet stated, well, it might be all right to eat on the holy days, go to rest on the holy days, but not the Sabbath. Be sure you don't eat leavened bread. So I give an indication once again of what was actually practiced back in that time period. Now I'll tell you what happened later on. Those meals had to be paid for. As I recall, they paid them, they just decided they were going to eat so many meals, and they'd pay them before they started eating at the feast. And later on, it got to the place where you couldn't depend on people coming and not coming, so Mr. Armstrong required everybody to buy meal tickets in advance. So the meals were paid for, all right. It's just a question of when they were paid for. Here's another article written in May 1962. We have here a virtually important principle of the preparation day, and of course we know that's Friday. Actually, this principle involves more than just preparing for food. And then on the Sabbath, her only, referring to the housewife, her only effort will be that of cooking light meals on the Sabbath, which is permissible, and warming up a few things and serving food. And this is what most people do. Now, has this been the practice that we have followed all these years? Absolutely. Have we ever advocated anybody just going out promiscuously eating in a restaurant on the Sabbath? Never. But are there exceptions? You bet there are. I'll get to some of those as we proceed here. So the question is asked in this article here, is it all right to eat in a restaurant on the Sabbath when you're away from home or on a trip? Now, according to what this article on the internet stated, no, what you're supposed to do is you are supposed to go to a restaurant or go to a store and buy some pizza and sandwiches and then stay in your motel room and eat pizza and sandwiches on the Sabbath. Now, is the Sabbath a pizza and sandwich day or is it a feast day? Would any of you invite all of your friends and neighbors over to a motel on the Sabbath day to eat pizza and sandwiches? In fact, most people who eat pizzas and sandwiches are eating a culinary nightmare anyway. Certainly pizza is one of the worst things you can eat. People just gobble it down. It's harmful for you. And practically every bit of the fast food that people eat is just loaded with carbohydrates and fats. And then people wonder why they get sick. Okay, here's what this article says. Now remember, this is 1962. Again, this question may be correctly answered by one or more scripture, but the best one is in Matthew 12, and we'll come back to that. I want to analyze it later on. In verse 1, Jesus describes how Jesus and his disciples were passing through a field of grain on the Sabbath and began to pluck the ears of grain and eat them. The Pharisees who saw them rebuked them, saying that they were breaking the law on the Sabbath day. Show me a law. Is that work? I'm going to take you through some scriptures that show the difference between work and servile work. I'm also going to show you what victuals are in the Bible, because those come up as issues. Beginning in verse 3, we have Christ's answer. He said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungered, and they that were with him, how they entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread? And then he says here, it was not lawful for him, but then he pointed out here, Have you not read on the Sabbath day that the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Now, this article on the internet stated that the only place that the priests were permitted to profane the Sabbath was in the temple, no place else. Well, now, let me ask you this question. Did Jesus change the priesthood? That's what it says in the book of Hebrews. There's a change in the priesthood. It's a New Testament priesthood. That's the New Testament ministry. Now, what do we read here? Verse 5 is particularly important to God's ministers. With very few exceptions, they have to work on the Sabbath. Most of them preach two sermons on the Sabbath and spend from 2 to 4 hours driving from one church to another. Believe me, that's work. Have the ministers broken the Sabbath? No, like the priests in the temple. They're doing the work of God and are blameless. I went out in the field in 1958 and took over 3 churches. By the time I left Denver and went by my circuit and returned home, it was 1,000 miles round trip. I went over 60,000 miles that year. I preached on Friday night in Garden City, Kansas. When I finished that Friday night, I drove 150 miles to Lamar, Colorado. I stayed overnight with about 3 or 4 hours of sleep that night, and then drove another 150 miles to Pueblo in the morning. I preached in Pueblo in the morning about 9:30. When I got done with that, I jumped in my car and I raced north of Denver to Lyons, Colorado, another 150 miles to preach there in the afternoon, and then returned back to Denver that evening, absolutely exhausted. Now, wouldn't it have been wonderful if I could have stopped and prepared a meal in the motel? I can tell you, the fellow that wrote this article that I read on the internet hasn't had any experience whatsoever. He doesn't know the price of putty, and yet proposes to notify everybody that he is God's watchman. It's his duty to warn. Well, he listens, should you eat on a restaurant on the Sabbath day? Well, the classic example takes place every year at the Feast of Tabernacles. We must travel from our homes to observe the feast in the place where God has placed his name. During that time, we're living in motels, hotels, and even camping out. For many of us, if we're going to eat at all, we must eat in a restaurant. Since the Sabbath is listed in Leviticus 23 as one of God's feasts, we certainly would expect to eat on that day. It actually is not normally to be a fast day. Furthermore, the people who prefer food in restaurants are going to be working whether you eat there or not. They're going to be working. And as a general rule, it would be better for us to prepare lunch ahead of time now listen carefully, here's a good point, or order those items on the menu that have been prepared ahead of time. Now, you know very well that restaurants have a standard fare. They have certain specials they change every day, and it varies back and forth, but they have certain dishes that they just prepare every day, and they're already made up in advance. This is the case with most of their specials. They prepare it ahead of time, and it is no extra work for them if we eat in their restaurant. The people in the restaurant are working whether you eat there or not, and of course it involves no work for you. Remember, Mark 2:27 said, Christ said that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. So that was written in 1962. Now here's another one that was written in September of 64. After the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, the Jews finally woke up to the dreadful sin of Sabbath breaking, so following their human nature, they began to go to the opposite extreme. And that's the way human beings are. I'm going to give a sermon here on the first holy day of the days of unleavened bread, on the leaven of doctrine. And I'm going to show you very plainly from the Bible. It says you'd better not either go to the left or to the right. Don't add or diminish. So they began to add, didn't they? They began to go the opposite extreme. False teachers called Pharisees, and they began making a ritualistic fetish out of the Sabbath. They added scores of technical, trivial, pointless do's and don'ts to God's original commandments, and so to the Jews the Sabbath became a grievous burden, a day of bondage, a legalistic technicality. So today Orthodox Jews have 613 do's and don'ts. Now, would you like to be in a religion like that? Every waking moment of your life, everything you did, you'd be asking yourself now, which rule am I following here or not following? They had a certain teacher there by the name of Joseph ben Joser, called Joseph the Permitter, and after at his time a veritable flood of new commandments issued forth from the Pharisees. It became a sin to carry as much as one dried fig on the Sabbath. To carry more than one swallow of milk on the Sabbath was sin. And to even carry a sheet of paper was absolutely forbidden. Work. Well, God never intended for the Sabbath to become a matter of legalistic interpretation into virtual bondage. Now, I'll give you an example. He cites a young man here who was trying to keep the Sabbath, and he said, they have some people ignorant of how to observe the Sabbath, have too self-consciously restricted themselves. One young man used to have a problem every time the Sabbath arrived. He existed in a tiny cubicle in a rooming house without cooking facilities. Well, why didn't he figure out some way to do all of his cooking? You know, people write this kind of stuff. They don't take into consideration people's circumstances, their livelihood, their income, their education, all that. They just make some blanket rule and everybody's just supposed to swallow it and follow hook, line, and sinker. So the rest of the week he ate his meals in local restaurants, but on the Sabbath he did not know what to do. He secluded himself in his bleak, barren apartment, his uninspiring four walls, every Sabbath, all day long. He tried to rejoice in these surroundings, but he felt hungry, a gnawing restlessness, and he was frankly bored. Have you at times felt the same way? The young man, without realizing, was following the example of the Pharisees. He was observing the Sabbath as a modern Pharisee. The result? Depression, seclusion, abstinence, loneliness. Is that the way God wants us to keep the Sabbath? Well, I won't read any more of that. I think that summarized that part. Now I'll just see if I can close this here. We are not responsible for the conduct of the world. What the world does is its own concern. If the world breaks God's Sabbath, a penalty will be exacted. God will hold the world accountable. And since we're not responsible for men working on the Sabbath, and since they will be working on God's time anyway, regardless of what we say or do, and since these things could be organized in such a way that no one would be required to work on the Sabbath, it is certainly all right for God's people to make use, now listen carefully, to make use of gas or electricity on the Sabbath. You know, you look at the extreme that these people go to, and if you're going to make a big issue about people working in a restaurant, and then why are you using electricity and are you using your utilities? You know, let's be consistent in this thing if we're going to go that route. These utility people work on Saturday, you can be sure of that. The Sabbath is a feast day, therefore families should plan ahead for the Sabbath. And he gives a series of things that can be done. With a little forethought, it can be a true feast. A little cooking, of course, can be done. It would be all right to prepare breakfast, for instance. All the work should be kept to a minimum, and a hearty breakfast can help give the day a zestful start. Use God's Sabbath. Use wisdom in observing it. Be balanced in your approach. Be neither hypocritical, self-righteous, pharisaical, nor a haphazard, sloppy, unmindful individual. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the middle of the road. Balance. Don't go to any extreme one way or the other. Now, here's the last one I'm going to read, and this is in October 1988, and you'll see the trend that's began to set in. I can tell you this, it never set in with us. We have never said, nor have we approved, or advocated any of you going out to restaurants on the Sabbath. And any time we've ever had an outing and a going here, what do? We wait till after sundown, don't we? But there are exceptions. When I used to preach in those churches, and have to make that long trip on the Sabbath. 1,000-mile round trip from the time I left to the time I got back. I'd sometimes stop, and beloved or not, I wouldn't do it anymore, I know better. I'd buy Kentucky Fried Chicken and eat it in the car on the road. Was that sinful? Well, probably eating the chicken was, but not buying it wasn't. Okay, this is from a Worldwide Church of God, October 1988. Now listen to this. You begin to see the trend setting in. The church has long taught it's not wrong to eat out on the weekly Sabbath occasionally or on the annual holy days, depending on the circumstances and preferences. That's partially true. See, it makes it the word occasionally. Now, how often are you out on a trip, and how long are you in circumstances where that's going to be an occasional thing? I say it should be an exception, not the rule, and it isn't that often. Now, this is a good point here, though. Listen to this. The waiters, waitresses, chefs, and the like who may serve in a restaurant are not our servants. Listen to this carefully. Are not our servants in the way described in the fourth commandment. So that's what this person who wrote this article has done. He's taken this fourth commandment and applied it to somebody working in a restaurant. They're not our servant. They're the restaurant servant. Despite the fact that he might say, well, if you tip them, you're hiring. I'm not hiring anybody. I don't have to even pay a tip if I don't want to. And I can tell you something else I can do. I can pay with a credit card. And I don't have to pay any money that day. That's collected later. They are the employees of the owner of the restaurant. They would be working regardless of whether or not we ate there. God does not hold us responsible for their working on the Sabbath just because we use their services, unless we're the only ones who ever ate in the restaurant on the Sabbath. And obviously, we make up a very small portion of the customers served in restaurants on the Sabbath or holy days. So that's a good point, all right. But I would say this. It was not that occasional. And if he's saying long taught, that had to be after the 70s when the watering process began to set this in. Now, we understood that the Sabbath was a feast day. Notice what we read here in Leviticus 23, verses 2 and 3. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord which you shall proclaim are holy convocations. These are my feasts. And what's the first one mentioned here? 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work in it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. No work. Keep that word work in mind. We'll come back to that. So it is a feast day. Not limited to pizza and sandwiches in a motel room. Now I want you to point something out. I think it's very, very important. You need to get this. Exodus 20 and verse number 8, and this particular text here, tell us how to keep the Sabbath. Exodus 20 gives a good summary of it here. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant. Notice the word, your. That's your servant. He's under your control. Now let me point something out to you. You may not be thought of it in this way. The Israelites utilized a system of slavery. It's not the kind of a slavery that we had in our American South. But it was similar in the sense that most of their slaves were captives from war. Although Israelites who got into some kind of deep financial trouble were sometimes sold into servitude to pay back their debts. They had to do it if they violated certain crimes and laws. They had to pay back doubled, maybe sometimes quadruple. And they were placed in servitude working for wages until they paid off that debt. Too bad we don't have that kind of system today. Instead of making all the taxpayers responsible for everything. So that's what your servant would be. And your male servant, your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the Sabbath day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now that's the statement regarding observing of the Sabbath. But now let's notice something here in Exodus 12, verse number 16. That's what it says about the Sabbath. Now, what does it say about the holy days? Exodus 12, verse 16. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation. So we're talking here about the days of unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation to you. No manner of work shall be done in them. So here we have this word work again. But that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. Ho-ho, what do we find here then? We find the holy days are an exception. Work can be done in food preparation only. Now, is that liable to involve quite a thing if it's a large group? Well, I can tell you this. I don't know if they still serve meals at the Feast of Tabernacles as late as the 70s when I left in 1975, but I can remember there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lined up to eat. And some of you will remember that. That's food preparation on one of the annual holy days. And even had to do it on the weekly Sabbath. Either that or go in your restaurant, or maybe just go to your motel room and have pizza and sandwiches. So you see, there is an exception on the matter of the weekly Sabbath and the annual holy days. Now, I remember one fellow. I used to refer to him as Mr. Pharisee. And he said, this text here applies only to the days of unleavened bread, not any of the other holy days. It makes you wonder how some people think. Let's notice something interesting here with respect to the holy days. In Exodus 23, Leviticus 23, once again, let's notice a statement here. I'm reading here from this New King James, but the authorized version has the word servile work here. That's why I said a moment ago, is there a difference between work and servile work? And you'll notice here, beginning on verse number 7, you shall do no, and this author, New King James Version says, customary work. That is a proper translation. That's far more understandable than the word servile. Customary work. Go on down the list here, and you'll see the same thing mentioned repeatedly on all of these holy days. It mentions no customary work. Verse 21, for example. And what's interesting, you come to the Day of Atonement, and it doesn't say that. It says, you shall do no manner of work. So on the Day of Atonement, there isn't any, but on the others, there is. So obviously, there was something permitted on those days. Verse 33, no customary work. 35, that's referring to the Feast of Tabernacles. On the eighth day, no customary work. Well, now, if it's making a difference between customary work and work, then there's a difference between the two, isn't there? What's the difference? So you see, all through these annual holy days, you find this servile work or customary work. You're not to do your actual customary work. Well, that implies then there is some other work you can do, doesn't it? Food preparation, just as we read. Now, what's the difference between work and servile work? Well, the word work, of course, both of them are very broad in meaning, but the word work itself applies to the Sabbath. You don't find the word servile work associated with the weekly Sabbath, only with the annual holy days. The word work, meaning craftsmanship, this is how it's translated various ways in the King James Version. Craftsmanship, goods, work, business, both skilled and unskilled. Now let's take a look at that word business here in just a moment. Because in this article that I read from the internet, it made the statement that if you go to a restaurant, you're doing business because it is a business. What does this word business mean? Does this apply to the word work? Well, just to give you some examples here, let me go through this as quickly as I can. Proverbs 18, verse number 9. Proverbs 18, verse number 9. He who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. Now, how could that be interpreted? Could mean a number of things, couldn't it? That's how the word is used. Now, notice again a number of examples of how it is used. Let's go back to Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse number 16. In Nehemiah 5, verse number 16, we read, "Indeed, I also continued to work on this wall." Remember, they were building the walls of Jerusalem? So the building of that wall was called work. In other words, it referred to the project at hand. Now, let's notice something interesting clear back here in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 39. And we find that Joseph went into the house. This is when he got in trouble with Potiphar's wife. And it happened, this is Genesis 39, verse 11. It happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work. And that word in the Authorized Version is business. That's exactly what it is. How many times have you heard people say, "Mind your own business"? Does that mean they were running a restaurant serving meals? See, that word just simply means whatever the work at hand, whatever you're doing, your project at hand, or one's personal business, or whatever. And you find a number of passages that illustrate the same thing. I won't read them all. I'll just mention them to you, and if you want to check them, you can check them. Here's Nehemiah 11, verse number 22. Psalm 107, verse 23. These I'm going to read here because I think they drive the point home quite well. Here's Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes 5, verse number 3. A dream comes through, and the Authorized Version has a multitude of business. What could that involve? Everything under the sun that you're involved in and thinking about. I don't know if this happens to you. It happens to me every once in a while. I'll watch one of these specials on TV that deals with snakes and spiders. And in the middle of the night, I'll be dreaming about spiders and snakes. You know, these things come in your mind, I guess, from whatever's been on your mind. So that gives you an idea there. Chapter 8, verse number 16. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, all the things that go on. Scurrying here, scurrying there, busy there, this event, that event. Doesn't necessarily imply being in one's business. And then in 1 Kings 9, verse number 23, you'll see that it refers to the king's business or work, the king's business at hand. And in 1 Samuel 8, verse number 16, it refers to the royal bureaucracy at work for the king. So the word work then obviously applies to any type of thing like that would be prohibited on the Sabbath day, because it's all these activities that do not involve rest, whatever they may be. Now remember, we read servile work with reference to the holy days. And what does the word servile work mean? Occupational work. customary work. The thing that you customarily do, laborious work associated with servitude and bondage. Now remember, we read here that work could be done on the holy days, but not servile work. There's a difference. Let's notice a couple of examples here. Deuteronomy 26 and verse number 6. Here's a case in point. Deuteronomy 26 and verse number 6. The Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. There's the word bondage. No servile work on the holy days. Now, if it's making a distinction between work and servile work, well, then what is it telling you? It's telling you that there is work that is permitted on the annual holy days, but not servile work. An example of servile work, I'll just mention this, and you can check it. It's Numbers 4, verse 23, and verse 47. It refers to the work of the ministers or the priests in the tabernacle, or the workers in the tabernacle. That was forbidden. And believe it or not, in Ezekiel 29, verse 18, it refers to Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers in service against Tyre. Hard, laborious work. Well, if you realize how they fought wars in those days, they had to surround a fenced city. They didn't have gunpowder, so they couldn't use cannons to knock the walls down. That came much later in the medieval period. But they had to build a big mound high enough to get across the wall. And that took, sometimes two or three years of hard labor to build that to break into the city. Hard work. Now, the primary texts that are used to support this notion are found in Nehemiah 10, verse number 31. Verse number 31, and Nehemiah 13, verse number 15. Nehemiah 10, verse 31. They took an oath or a vow here at the latter part of verse 30 that we would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. I want you to notice something here. If the people of the land brought wares. Now, what's the word wares mean? It means merchandise, farm produce, or goods. If they brought that, or any grain, and they have this correct here. We have this word victuals. That word is a misleading word, frankly, because most people, when they think of victuals, they think of sitting down and eating a meal. Every single example in the Bible where you find this, it is not referring to sitting down eating a meal. It's talking about bulk amounts of food, produce, and things of that nature. Here's grain. Here's the word grain. It comes from the Hebrew word, the root meaning to crush. So what do you do with grain? You crush it. And then you eat it in the form of flour, don't you? If they brought those to sell on the Sabbath day, we would not buy it from them on the Sabbath day. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about marketable commodities. We're talking about public trade. We're talking about merchandise. And we're talking about various goods. Are we talking about eating a meal anywhere? Why read into something it doesn't say? Now let's go to Nehemiah 13, verse number 15. In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Proper translation. Victuals is misleading. Now, it probably wasn't misleading to the English at the time they wrote this. They understood what it meant. Is it talking about a meal in a restaurant? Is it talking about some little petty amount of food that a person may eat? No, we're talking about big stores of goods. We're talking about huge amounts of produce. We're talking about business. Doing business on the Sabbath. So they were profaning the Sabbath day. And then you find here, men of Tyre dwelt there who brought in fish and all kinds of wares and sold them on the Sabbath. And so what they were doing was breaking the Sabbath, very clearly. They were merchandising, buying and selling and that kind of thing on the Sabbath. Had nothing to do with eating a meal in an emergency situation. Now, let's take a look at this word victuals. What does it mean? This exact same word that's used here is used 7 times in the Old Testament. That is this exact word. Now, what you have to realize about the Hebrew is that the number and gender is determined by suffixes and prefixes. So you'll find the same root word used elsewhere with a suffix or a prefix, and that's why they only list this exact word 7 times. But I've checked every single one of these texts to see where this root word is used, and I think this will give you the gist of it. You might be surprised to find this out. The word victuals in a number of cases means a hunter. It says very plainly, Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. There's the words translated victuals. What is it implying? He provided food. Esau was a good hunter. Same word, victuals. Here's one I think I'll turn to. Let's go to the book of Proverbs, chapter 12. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse number 27. A lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting. There's the word. That's how it's used in many, many places. Now, it's not only limited to that, however, because it also refers to provisions. Never once does it refer to sitting down and eating a meal. Let us notice Genesis 42, verse number 25. Here's a good example. Genesis 42 and verse number 25. Remember, this is when Joseph's brothers were down there and they were after food, and then he sent them back home. And we read here, Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions. Here's the word used for victuals. Provisions. For the journey. Now they were given not only feed for their stock, but food for themselves. And you remember when they were examined, they all had sacks of grain, didn't they? Now let's notice an example or two here in the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 1, verse number 11. Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, and this is verse 10, pass through the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you'll cross over this Jordan. Here's the word victuals. Provisions. Doesn't refer to a meal. Doesn't even refer to the Sabbath. In chapter 9, verse number 5, Joshua chapter 9 and verse number 5. Here were these people from Gibeon who deceived the Israelites into thinking they were from a far off country when they were very near. And so they deceived them into thinking that they were no danger to them, and they were poor and they weren't worth conquering. So they unwisely signed a pact with them. And it says here, they were craftily in verse 4. They had, verse 5, old and patched sandals on their feet and old garments on themselves. And all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And I think this is victuals here. I know I'd have to check my King James. Okay, it's provisions. All right, now notice in verse number 14. Then the men of Israel took some of their victuals. Is that talking about eating a meal in a restaurant? That's talking about large amounts. Whatever, how many donkeys they brought and how much they brought. Now, here's something that's even more interesting. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 21. You'll remember this is when David was fleeing from Saul, and he had these young men with him. I forget the exact number. That's not what is important here, though. And he came to Abimelech, the priest, and he said, verse 3, this 1 Samuel 21, verse 3, "Now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found." And notice what this bread was. This is the exact thing Jesus referred to when he said he went to the priest and got the showbread. Verse number 6 says, "There was no bread there but the showbread." Now, what was the showbread? That was bread that was made and set up, kept a week, and then the following Sabbath it was removed and replaced by fresh bread, and it was a symbol, I'm sure, the bread of life. But here's what's significant about this. He said 5 loaves. A loaf consisted, it was made from 6 1/4 pounds of flour. Now, how big of a loaf could you make with 6 1/4 pounds of flour? And if you had 5 of them, what do you give him here? 31 1/4 pounds of flour made into bread. That's a considerable amount of bread, isn't it? It wasn't just a little snack. They didn't sit down and have some victuals and have a little meal. Now, how do we know it's victuals? Well, look over here in chapter 22 and verse number 10. Ahimelech, he was Doeg, you know, and he, if I can use a colloquial term, he ratted on him. And so he says what he said. He's telling the king what he did. He inquired of the Lord, and he gave him provisions. Isn't that victuals in the King James? Sure. Yeah. How many loaves of bread would that make? How large of a supply of bread would that be? You'd probably need a cart to carry it. So that makes it very plain that it's talking about large amounts. One other example is in Psalm 78, verse 25, where it says, I think as I recall, you can check it, Psalm 78, 25, that... we ate the food or the meat of angels. So it's a general term, but it's not certainly not limited to a rest or meal. All right, with that in mind now, what do the New Testament examples reveal? All right, let's notice Luke. This man made the remark in this article I'm referring to on the internet. He said that he asserts that the work on the Sabbath was restricted to an emergency of life and death, of life, limb, or property. So we're looking at a matter of life and death, he says. Well, let's notice what happened here. Here's what Jesus said, Luke 13, verse number 15. Luke 13, verse number 15. He healed a man, as you recall, on the Sabbath, and then they said, it's all right to heal, but not on the Sabbath. And then Jesus said, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it?" Is that a life and a death situation? You know, you might get hungry thirsty. Have you ever seen stock that get thirsty? They just stand around and bawl. They're not going to die. What if you're out on some trip somewhere and you're traveling and you didn't have any feed for your stock and it ended up on the Sabbath day? But you're not going to feed them because you'd be doing work. That's extreme that some of these people would like to carry these things. Luke 14, verse number 5. He answered and said to them, "Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day?" Well, if he stayed in there long enough, he would die, no doubt. But he's doubtful he would just die that moment. It's not a matter of life and death necessarily at all. Matthew 12, verse number 10. The reason I'm pointing this out is to try to say it's a matter of life and death and then equate that to human beings is stretching it a long way. Matthew 12, verse number 10. There was a man that had a withered hand, and he said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, that they might accuse him? And then, of course, here's what he said. What man is there among you who has one sheep, or if it falls in a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Now, here's what I want to read the next verse to you. Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Now, of course, that's specifically referring to healing a man, but just it's a principle I think we need to understand. We want to take these legalistic things and then put ourselves in a straitjacket, and somehow we're doing God a favor. Why do we demand things that God doesn't demand, or the Bible's not clear on? If it's that important to God, would he not make it plain? Make a mountain out of a molehill is what happens. Luke 6, verse number 1. Luke 6, verse number 1. It happened on the second Sabbath after the first, he went through the grain fields. And this is the incident here where they plucked these heads of grain and ate them, and then they said, you're doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. What law? Is that work? If the word work means laborious work, your customary work, the things that you do for a living and your livelihood is shelling a few pieces of grain work. Well, I guess if these Jews thought if you carried a weight of a fig, you were breaking the Sabbath, or if you hit a fly with a fly swatter, you were hunting on the Sabbath, they'd think that. And there are people, really, that are that narrow-minded, frankly. And then he explained the whole thing, just as I read to you now. And here's what I'll emphasize in verse number 5. He said to them, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. What is he saying? He's saying here that human need is often more important than legalism. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, he said. These people wanted sacrifice. That is, they wanted the legalistic application of everything. Luke 14, verses 1 through 3. Luke 14, verses 1 through 3. I think this is interesting here because it shows you what went on here in the house of a Pharisee. It happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath. So they were eating a meal. And behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. Now, we don't know whether or not the man had been invited there deliberately to set a trap for Christ or whether he just walked in the door. The Bible doesn't say. But in any case here, Jesus answering spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees. Did you get that? To the lawyers and Pharisees. Good sized group there, wasn't there? Now, how much work was involved on the Sabbath taking care of them? You know, you ladies, we have our snacks on the Sabbath, and we have our potlucks. How long does it take you to prepare things? It takes you a little time, doesn't it? It takes a little time to set up the tables, takes a little time to set up the chairs, takes a little time to get the meals all ready to go, doesn't it? Are you Sabbath breaking? Is that work? Is that your customary work? Is that your labor? Of course not. Well, then why make an issue on a holy day? I want to emphasize this regarding the holy days. The holy days always take precedence over the weekly Sabbath when the two fall on the same date. How many times do we have that happening? So to come up with this idea that you can eat on the holy days, all right, but not on the weekly Sabbath, that's nothing but Phariseeism, plain and simple. That is not the intention of God's commandments and God's laws. It's the attitude you have behind you that determines whether or not you're keeping the Sabbath properly, and you can break it in a thousand ways without breaking it in that way. How you talk, what you think about, how you spend your time on the Sabbath? So the question we need to answer here then is, when can we eat out on the Sabbath day? Only on rare occasions and emergencies only. If you happen to be traveling, you're out somewhere and you're in such a situation, there's no way you can prepare for it. Are you sinning by eating in a restaurant on the Sabbath? Of course not. What if you do it every time you get a chance? What if you're creating a ox in the ditch situation every Friday night so you can do it? That's absolutely wrong. So you need to realize we have always taught respect for the Sabbath. But to get confused over the difference between a Sabbath and a holy day, I think needs to be thought out very carefully. Just let common sense prevail. That's the key. Good common sense and balance. So let me summarize by saying the following. The things that God is concerned about are made very plain in the Bible. There is no doubt. If the Bible doesn't mention anything about it, then why do we have to make ourselves more righteous than God? Number two, the church's long precedence in keeping the Sabbath the way it kept it, just as I read from that literature. And you know something? The church was blessed for 40 years, where we had a 30% increase just year after year after year. Until when? All of a sudden it dawned on them they were breaking the Sabbath? Of course not. It's when they changed Pentecost and divorced and remarried. And it went down the tubes from that time on. So it was blessed for 40 years keeping the Sabbath the way it did and the holy days. Number three, the whole issue on this thing about eating out on the Sabbath involves an interpretation of Nehemiah 10 and Nehemiah 13. And all it is an interpretation because the text is not supported and the usage of the words do not support it. What did Jesus illustrate in the New Testament? He showed what was wrong with Pharisaism and this legalism to the point where they'd made the Sabbath a day of bondage. Now, if you're that kind of a person and you think you're going to please God by doing that, be my guest. But I can tell you this, don't come around preaching it to anybody else, and don't be sitting in judgment of anybody else because you're more righteous than the rest of us. God will determine that. God forbids adding to His Word. I'm going to cover that on the first annual High Sabbath day, these days of unleavened bread. And the last thing I want to do, let's turn to Ecclesiastes 7, verse number 16 here. It's a good point to keep in mind. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. That ought to be good advice for anyone who suddenly somehow got the notion in his or her head that the church was wrong all these years and all of a sudden, eureka, we have found the light. Nonsense. If that's your viewpoint, all you've found is Phariseeism, which you should have understood years ago.